Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. It was, said the British ambassador to Israel today, a gruesome new low for Hamas, that the body of a young mother, Shiri Bibas, abducted on October 7th, 2023, has not been returned, as promised by the militant group Hamas as part of the current ceasefire, and that Israeli officials say their pathologists have shown that Shiri's two young children, Ariel and Kefir, whose bodies were handed over on Thursday, had not been killed in an Israeli airstrike, as Hamas claimed, but had been, in the words of the Israeli authorities, murdered by terrorists. Indeed, just within the last few minutes, the chief spokesman of the Israeli Defense Forces, Daniel Hagari, says that the those pathological inquiries show that, in his words, the terrorists did not kill them by gunfire. They killed them with their own hands. Hamas, for its part, says it's investigating whether there was, as it puts it, a mix-up over the body of Shiri Bibas. This is a particular shade of agony for her husband and the father of Ariel and Kefir, Yarden Bibas, who was released from captivity in Gaza on the 1st of February, apparently until that point unaware that his wife and children were dead. There are also big questions over what this means for the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Just before we came on air, we got this statement from Ofri Bibas, the sister of Yarden and the aunt of Ariel and Kefir. This is part of what she had to say.
האחיינים המתוקים שלי נחטפו מביתם בחיים ונרצחו על ידי ארגון טרור אכזרי בשבי. לא הגיע להם גורל כזה. המסע הכואב שלנו שנמשך כבר 16...
My sweet nephews were taken alive from their home and murdered by a cruel terrorist organization while in captivity. They didn't deserve such a fate. Our painful journey, which has already lasted 16 months, is not over. October 7th continues. We are still waiting for Shiri and fear for her fate. Shiri, Ariel and Kefir were taken alive by a murderous terrorist organization, and it was Israel's responsibility and obligation to bring them back alive. There is no forgiveness for abandoning them on October 7th, and no forgiveness for abandoning them in captivity. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, we did not receive an apology from you in this painful moment. For Ariel and Kefir's sake, and for Yarden's sake, we are not seeking revenge right now. We are asking for Shiri.
The words of Ofri Bibas. We've tried today to get hold of a current member of Hamas to ask them about the Bibas family. We've been unable to do so, but we did manage to get through to Ahmed Yusuf. He was a senior advisor to the former Hamas leader, Ismail Haniyeh. What does he make of the apparent debacle of the body of Shiri Bibas?
I have heard the spokesperson of Hamas just a few minutes ago have said that there is something happened because that building being demolished and there are many bodies there. Maybe some mistakes there, and they will investigate to see if this is really what the Israeli claim is right or not.
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis also dispute that she and her children were killed in an airstrike. They say that they were killed by the people who captured them in November 2023. So it's wrong that they were killed in an airstrike. But come what may, I mean, there's also the bigger question as to whether the bodies of an Israeli mother and her two small children should be used as bargaining chips by Hamas in this way. What are your thoughts?
I believe that nobody from Hamas side, I don't think they are trying to play games. They would like to continue the truce and they would like to be trustworthy in the way they are handling the agreement that they have negotiated in Qatar and Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is whether in the first instance they should have held on to the bodies of these three, however they died, for all this time. The other thing that I think has caused a great deal of upset, and not just in Israel, is the way in which the coffins were handed over in this big parade that was put on Thursday in Khan Yunis. You know, the triumphal music, the theatrical backdrop. I mean, the head of the UN Human Rights Agency, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, said it was abhorrent and cruel, flies in the face of international law, that the coffins were handed over to the Red Cross in this way. What do you make of that spectacle?
What I know from the mentality of Hamas, they're trying to do something reflecting their image in very positive side. They're trying to do, they are not a professional in how to handle things like this, but they try to be, they are treated their hostage in a better way. And that's what we have seen in different way they handling this exchanging a prisoner. The way that the Israeli handling a prisoner and torturing them and beating them and also humiliating them. And Hamas, they are dealing with the hostage in very positive way, but the Israeli is trying to do the opposite.
May I ask you about the summit that is happening today, the meeting in Saudi Arabia of several Arab countries, which essentially has been called in response to Donald Trump's idea that somehow Palestinians all be moved out of Gaza, whether you want it or not, and that Jordan and Egypt take in 2 million plus Gazans. Now, the proposal that seems to be under consideration in Saudi Arabia involves a technocratic government to take over the Gaza Strip, to take over the running of the Gaza Strip before it is then rebuilt. A technocratic government would not, by definition, involve Hamas. Do you think that idea is at all feasible?
I don't think Hamas is interested to rule Gaza again. They're just willing to be part of any arrangement, and I don't think anybody will stand to fight the Egyptian or Arab army or police force who will take care of the stability and security and the prosperity of Gaza.
That was Ahmed Yusuf speaking to me from Khan Yunis in Gaza. What might all this mean for the prospects of the ceasefire continuing? Dan Meridor was a former deputy prime minister of Israel in the Likud party, the same party that the current prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu leads. What's his reaction first to the news that Shiri Bibas's body was not returned with those of her children?
Of course, the story of the two young boys of 9 months and 2 years or 4 years, the way they've been murdered was awful with their mother. We thought that we would have the corpses, but the process showed that the two boys, that they were murdered not by some bomb of, as they say, the Israeli army, but more and not less terrifying, the fact that it's not the mother's body. They might not have wanted to give it back, either because they don't know or that there's some evidence there that the way she was murdered, I don't know why. But the whole thing is awfully tragic and sad. And in Israel, we all are watching TV and then trying to wash our eyes from tears because it really touches the heart of everybody here.
Given what you've said, and given that this current phase of the ceasefire is due shortly to come to an end, we're going to get, Hamas says, the release of the last group of Israeli hostages in this current phase. That will happen on Saturday. Six further Israeli hostages will be released, and there will be a release of Palestinian prisoners by the Israelis. What do you think should happen now? Because it does seem as if the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is under competing pressures as to, you know, how strongly he should push for this ceasefire to be extended.
Well, you see, it's my old-fashioned habit not to attack my government when I speak abroad. But I'll tell you what I think. If I were to make decisions, I would try to have all of them in one action, not prolonged in many phases. I think it's reckless. I know that the result is that you can't get rid of the Hamas at this phase. But Hamas, unfortunately, is there. For them, it's a religious commitment not to allow a Jewish state to survive. So they will give us enough opportunities to deal with them in the future and hit them badly as you can. But I would not condition this now. I would like to have all the hostages back. It's not an easy deal. We release from prisons people who were convicted with murder, with terror activities, and it's bad. It's not good. But you have to make choice between bad alternatives. And we have responsibility as a government, as a country, to our citizens. People were kidnapped from their beds in the morning, doing nothing bad to anybody from within Israel, and they were taken, murdered, some maimed, some raped, and taken hostages. We need to bring them back home. And unfortunately, God forbid, somebody gets into your house and takes your children, a robber, and says, I want money or else. So you reluctantly have to pay the money because you care about your children first, and then deal with the rest. I would do this this way.
What do you say to those who argue, and the case has been made inside Israel, that actually what you're asking for could well have been delivered earlier had the Prime Minister agreed earlier for there to be a ceasefire?
My sense is that we should have done it as early as possible. Of course, we hit the Hamas badly, and rightly so, and good that they were hit badly. But there's a long time now, it's 16 months of a war. It shouldn't have been that long, and I would have done it earlier if it were possible.
Yeah. And you know Benjamin Netanyahu. He's been around in politics almost as long as you. Just give me a sense of how you think, because there are competing pressures on him. I mean, we've been told that the American administration, and in particular Steve Witkoff, President Trump's Middle East envoy, is very keen for phase two of the ceasefire, as it's called, to go ahead. But equally, Mr. Netanyahu is under pressure from some in his government, notably Bezalel Smotrich, the far-right minister, to return to war. How do you think he will handle those competing pressures?
You put me on the edge of criticizing the Israeli government. I don't like to do this, but I'll tell you what the priority that I would put. The maintaining the government, continuing with the coalition that he has, is very important to every politician. But there should be limits to it. And if it's a question of either the hostages or the government falls, I have to say, and maybe this is why I'm out of politics now, I would put first the interests of the public, of the human interest. The people should come home back as soon as possible. I hope the government, he should hope the government will not fall. It may fall, so go to elections. And let's see what happens. We have a new player in the team here called Mr. Trump. I have to say I can't decipher this enigma, what he will do. Will he do this or that? It's all open. We saw it. If he does the things that I think are right, like pressuring everybody to continue with the deal, to return everybody home, then I praise him for that.
The former Likud minister, Dan Meridor. You're listening to NewsHour. And coming up on this programme, as the US pivots away from Europe towards Asia Pacific and the challenge of China, our correspondent Jonathan Head is fighting to make himself heard.
We're heading out to the USS Carl Vinson, one of the world's largest aircraft carriers. It's currently out in the Pacific, off the coast of the Philippines. And this is how they're going to take us there, in one of the US Navy's innovative tilt-rotor Osprey aircraft. They are quite amazing looking, like something out of Star Wars.
That report from Jonathan Head coming up in just over 20 minutes. Our main headline this hour, the aunt of the two young children returned in coffins by Hamas says the family does not seek revenge, even as the Israeli Prime Minister has accused Hamas of a cruel and evil violation of the ceasefire in Gaza. You are the BBC World Service and this is NewsHour, live from London. For more than a decade, West Africa has been in the grip of an opioid crisis. Thousands of lives have been ruined by powerful and illegal pills packaged as medicines and sold on the streets. But up to now, no one has exposed the pharmaceutical executives behind this deadly trade. Our investigations unit, BBCI, has been probing the companies which are making and shipping these pills and the men profiting from addiction. Yahoo Masahudu has this report.
Here in my hometown of Tamale in northern Ghana, illegal opioids are destroying young lives. The problem has become so bad, locals have set up a task force to stop the dealers.
We have to try all our best as a community to see the best we can do. That is what we are doing.
Bikoko runs a local bakery. He is also one of the task force leaders.
Let's go.
Today, they've had a tip-off we are heading to one of the poorest neighborhoods in Tamale.
Let's go.
Okay. What is happening right now is the task force is here to arrest the drug dealers.
I don't know anything. I don't deal drugs.
You see how you disgrace yourself to this low? Look at kids are watching you. So you want to destroy people's children?
As we pass through the tight streets, we see addicts who are clearly under the effects of these addictive and highly dangerous drugs. Some take them as painkillers, some to help them get through hard physical work, but many use them simply to get high.
This place is being invaded by the drug peddlers. So that's why we are here this afternoon, to see their source of where they are getting the drugs.
The task force detains several men and seizes hundreds of opioid pills. I'm told that this is an almost daily occurrence. So where are the pills coming from? All we have to go on are clues on the packets seized. A made in India stamp, and in the corner, a logo, an A with a leaf at the bottom. It's the same logo turning up on opioid pills on the streets of Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, and Nigeria. Pills that are a particularly dangerous combination of opioid and muscle relaxant. We tracked the manufacturer back to India in a company called Aveo Pharmaceuticals. An undercover operative agreed to go inside Aveo's factory, posing as a businessman looking to supply opioids to Nigeria.
Hello ladies, we're here to see Mr. Sharma.
Vinod Sharma is one of the directors of Aveo. He manages his factory outside Mumbai.
So, yes, sir. So nice to see you.
After giving them a tour of the factory, they sit down to talk business.
I can clear from our custom. You can clear from your side. Every client working like this tablet is very powerful. Suppose you can use the two or three tablets in the one time, you can like this relax. Yeah.
This is what the kids like. That's what they like. Gives them that high.
This is very harmful for the health. Mm. But customer cannot understand. Mm. Now that this is a business.
It's business, yeah.
In India, any drug made only for export must comply with the requirements of the importing country. Ghana's drug authority told us this product does not meet their import requirements. By shipping these drugs to Ghana, Aveo is breaking Indian law. Back in Tamale, it's left for groups like the Citizens Task Force to tackle the opioid crisis. That evening, they gather in the local park to ban the drugs. But as they ban, production lines in India churn out millions more, driving a public health crisis across the whole of West Africa. We put these allegations to Vinod Sharma and Aveo Pharmaceuticals. They did not respond. The Indian drugs regulator, the CDSCO, told us India recognizes its responsibility towards global public health. It said the country's drug regulatory system is strong and strict action will be taken against any pharmaceutical firm involved in malpractice. It called upon importing countries to support India's efforts by enforcing similarly strong regulations. Yahya Masaudu, BBC News.
And as Yahya was saying, that was a report by Yahya Masaudu on the opioid trade in West Africa. Surgeons in London have become the first in the world to successfully preserve the sight of young children who were born with a rare genetic condition. The details of the study, published in the Lancet Medical Journal, explain how the vision of four patients was restored through the use of gene therapy. One of the study's authors is Professor James Bainbridge. He's a retinal surgeon from University College London and Moorfields Eye Hospital.
So these children were essentially blind from birth, owing to a lack of a gene that's critical for normal eyesight. And in the severest form of this condition, children have really very little sight even at birth. They can perhaps see light and dark. And that little bit of sight they face losing within the first few years of life. And of course, sight is really critical for development. And we were delighted to see that the new treatment could improve their sight really remarkably, not just preserve the sight because they had very little to start with, but actually to improve it.
Can you explain to me what it was that you were doing here?
The aim is to provide the cells in the retina with the gene that's otherwise lacking. Healthy copies of this gene can be generated in the laboratory, packaged in a disabled virus, and injected directly into the retina. And the virus delivers the gene into the cells that need that gene in order to provide the protein that's critical to kickstart, if you like, the function of the retina and indeed the normal eyesight. So that's how it's done. And the injection of the suspension of genes is done during surgery, which lasts approximately 1 hour to do.
And how quickly were you able to observe results?
So within a month or two, the parents of these young kids were describing notable improvements.
And was this therapy performed in both eyes or just one eye?
So in the first instance, we injected just one eye because we were unsure about the safety and so wanted to protect the kids against harm from side effects. Having established the treatment in those four children, others have gone on to have injections in both eyes.
Right. And, I mean, what sort of effects are the parents reporting?
It's been really remarkable. The children who would otherwise be expected to have really no sight at all can run around safely without bumping into things. They can recognise faces, recognise shapes, see their toys. They can reach for small objects on the toys. They can interact socially much more comfortably. And so it's had an amazing effect on their general development.
Now, you performed this on four children successfully. Were there other children who you've tried this on who maybe it hasn't had such a good effect? Or is it just, you know, it's a small sample, but so far it's been 100% success?
So in these four children, only one of their eyes was treated. In each instance, the treated eye improved remarkably in sight, whereas the untreated eye just lost a little bit of sight that it had. Additional children with this rare condition have been treated in both eyes, and they've all reported improvements which are similar to those we saw in the first kid. So it really looks to be consistently effective.
Gosh. One of the other things that's often said about gene therapy is that it's quite expensive and perhaps difficult to scale. Can you tell me how sort of far you think this type of therapy may be extended and also perhaps to other types of sight loss as well?
The expense is a real challenge, but I think the first thing to say is that it's hard to price the value of eyesight. Secondly, I think the technology is an early stage, and so it's very likely that with further development it can become more manageable, more feasible to manufacture more cheaply. So we already have on the NHS one gene therapy for a similar condition which is rather less severe. The outcomes of this particular treatment show that the same approach can work in a condition which is even more severe. These findings, this experience, helps pave the way for the development of treatments that could be helpful for children with more common blind diseases in the future.
That was Professor James Bainbridge from University College London and Moorfields Eye Hospital here in London. There's more about this on our website if you head to the health pages of BBC News website, bbc.com/news. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. An award-winning Franco-Algerian novelist has been in custody in Algeria for the last 3 months. Boualem Sansal, who's 80 and suffering from cancer, was arrested at Algiers airport in November when he went to visit his family. He's being held for breaching state security, but details of the charges against him are not known. His French lawyer still hasn't been granted a visa to see him. From Paris, Hugh Schofield.
With his long grey ponytail, Boualem Sansal was a familiar face in the French media. This was him on a popular chat show a few years ago when he'd released a new novel. He was a kind of go-to guy on Algeria, not least because he was very critical of the government.
Boualem Sansal.
France Inter. L'écrivain franco-algérien Boualem Sansal.
So it was a shock when, in November, it was announced that on a visit to Algiers, Sansal had been arrested at the airport under state security laws.
I am the publisher of the last book of Boualem Sansal.
Paris publisher Jean-François Colosimo knows Boualem Sansal well. He describes him as a humane and gentle person and a genuine free thinker.
Above all, he's a man who trusts in human brotherhood. He's a man who trusts in a love for the cosmos, for history, for the different people and their cultures. He's really a man of peace.
So what has angered the Algerian government so much about him?
He says the truth about the official history. He puts it down for a kind of regime like the one that, unfortunately, the Algerian people have today on their back. Truth is unbearable.
Parce que, tout simplement, c'est qu'au lendemain de l'indépendance, c'est ça...
Sansal had been getting up the nose of the Algerian government for many years. From semi-exile in France, he wrote about corruption, about what he saw as the carve-up of power between the Algerian military and Islamists, about the threat to France of Islamists. And in this interview, on a website close to France's hard-right National Rally Party not long before his arrest, he may have overstepped the mark, calling into question aspects of Algeria's official account of its own history. On the internet, the reaction from pro-Algerian influencers in France has been vitriolic, accusing Sansal of being a stooge for Marine Le Pen. The president of Algeria, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, gave an interview saying that the whole affair was a concoction intended to mobilize opinion against Algeria. The truth is that Boualem Sansal is caught up in a bigger crisis, which is the recent breakdown in relations between France and Algeria, possibly the worst since Algerian independence 60 years ago. Sansal is a victim and a kind of hostage. He's never written a word that is seditious or inflammatory, merely described the world around him as he sees it. His lawyer, still waiting for the chance to visit him in prison, is François Zimeret.
As all free thinkers, his thoughts and beliefs might have shocked or irritated. This is incumbent to freedom of speech, in fact, but I still don't see how his words could have endangered a state of 45 million inhabitants.
And that report from Paris from our correspondent, Hugh Schofield. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. The prospects for the more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza depend most directly and most immediately on whether the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas can be maintained. Phase one of that ceasefire, release of some of the hostages, Israel freeing correspondingly larger numbers of Palestinian prisoners and a limited Israeli troop withdrawal from Gaza. That's all due to end next week. Longer term, though, there's the question of what to do with the pulverized enclave of Gaza, who should govern it and how it can be, or how it should be, rebuilt. Donald Trump's proposal, somehow to ship out all the Palestinians and redevelop it into the Riviera of the Middle East, has been in much of the world deplored and ridiculed in equal measure. But one thing his proposal has prompted is for Arab countries to hold a crisis summit on Gaza, especially given that Mr. Trump has insisted that Egypt and Jordan should rehouse all Gazan Palestinians. So Arab leaders have been meeting today in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Lina Khatib is associate fellow at the Middle East and North Africa program at the think tank Chatham House in London. She says Donald Trump is casting a long shadow over the talks.
It seems that Trump's negotiating style is to start with maximalist, almost impossible demands so that this spurs others into action. And this seems to be playing out in the context of Gaza. Arab countries had to respond with public statements to what Trump had asked for, and then very quickly said that they were going to come up with their own proposal. So in a way, it seems that Trump's style is working out for Trump.
The signals that we've been getting, and indeed, I mean, the Egyptians before today's meeting, they floated this idea of basically a technocratic administration of Palestinians to take over the running of the Gaza Strip, security to be provided perhaps by outside Arab countries, and certainly Arab money to be invested in the redevelopment of Gaza. Do you think what we've heard from them is plausible?
When it comes to funding, Arab countries together can raise the funds, especially Gulf countries that have the means to do so. What they want to do as well is make sure that the Palestinians are not displaced from Gaza. And this is a red line for Arab countries. They do not want to see large numbers of Palestinians move elsewhere. And they certainly want to see Gaza secure so that cycles of violence do not repeat themselves again.
The countries at this meeting today, they don't always see eye to eye, particularly over the role of Islamism in the region. Do you think they can find common cause on this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to the Gaza conflict, for the most part, the Arab countries have been more united than divided regarding what they want to see next. Some principles they agree on are a restart of the peace process, Palestinians not displaced from Gaza, and also they really want the Palestinian Authority to be the one in charge in Gaza. This is something that all Arab countries actually agree on, and they have communicated that time and time again.
You mentioned a restart of the peace process. I mean, do you think that the time may come sometime soon when these Arab countries may be asking whether the what's called the Arab Peace Initiative, which essentially sort of calls for a two-state solution, that those Arab countries are going to say it's gone, it's dead, there's no chance of this happening now?
Actually, it's the opposite. The meeting happening in Saudi Arabia and other meetings that have happened in the context of the Gaza conflict have all affirmed Arab commitment to the Arab Peace Initiative. This remains the only initiative agreed on by all Arab countries, and it was an initiative that Saudi Arabia led on in 2002. It's a case of the United States, frankly, convincing Israel to actually take part in any peace talks. And this is, you know, not something on the horizon so far. But that's definitely what the Arab countries are trying to do by meeting in Saudi Arabia, signaling unity, signaling that they are proactive, that they have a plan, that they are not waiting for instructions from Washington, that they can come up with their own regional proposals as well.
Lina Khatib, Associate Fellow at the think tank in London, Chatham House. That is all for the longer term. These discussions about how Gaza might be rebuilt, might be governed. First, there's a question of how the latest choreography in this phase of the ceasefire will go and the chances that the truce can be extended. Let's get the latest from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen. And actually, Mark, even before we get on to that, I mean, there's been further very distressing allegations from the Israel Defense Forces about how these Bibas kids died. What can you tell us?
Yeah, Daniel Hagari, the spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces, has just given a briefing, Tim, in which he hit out at Hamas's claim that the Bibas family had been killed by Israeli bombardment during the war. He said that those were lies, and he said that according to Israeli forensics tests and intelligence, the Bibas boys, Kfir, who was just 9 months when he was seized on the 7th of October, and Ariel, who was just 4 years old, were murdered in the first weeks of the war. Murdered, he said, in cold blood. They were not shot. He said that they were killed by hand, and that Hamas then did terrible things, in his words, to cover it all up. And he said that they have, Israel has transferred those findings to the international community. He also accused Hamas of gross violations, in his words, of the ceasefire deal by not returning the body of Shiri Bibas, their mother, the boy's mother, claiming that she was one of the bodies in those four coffins transferred to Israel yesterday. But according to forensics tests here, it was in fact the remains of an unidentified Gazan woman. Hamas said there had been mistakes, and that the bodies had been mixed beneath the rubble in Gaza.
And just in terms of the ceasefire deal as it's currently constructed, the next part of it is due to be choreographed tomorrow. Tell me what we can expect.
We're expecting six living hostages to be handed over to Israel in exchange for more than 600 Palestinian prisoners freed from Israeli jails. Now, we've had the names of the six hostages that Hamas intends to release. Four of them were seized on the 7th of October, three of those from the Nova Festival, which was that music festival on the border with Gaza that was attacked in the early hours of the 7th of October with more than 360 people killed there. And one of them was is the father of a family who was seized from a kibbutz. And then the two others, the last two, were actually Israelis who strayed into Gaza in 2014 and 2015, both suffering from psychological problems, and they've been held ever since. For the time being, there is no indication that this rage, this intense agony over the fate of the Bibases is going to endanger tomorrow's handover of the hostages and Palestinian prisoners. But of course, there is intense fury from the Israeli government and still pressure from the right wing of Benjamin Netanyahu's government not to progress further with the ceasefire deal, not to go into the second phase of the ceasefire deal, and accusing Hamas of gross violations.
Mark Lowen in Jerusalem, thank you very much. After the Trump administration stunned Europe with his decision to start talks with Russia about ending the war in Ukraine and shaking faith in the strength of transatlantic security guarantees, American allies in the Asia-Pacific region are nervously waiting to see what Washington has in store for them. The U.S. still underwrites the security of Japan and South Korea, and the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet is almost constantly in the region, often conducting exercises with other navies. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head was invited to visit one of the U.S. Navy's largest aircraft carriers.
We're heading out to the USS Carl Vinson, one of the world's largest aircraft carriers. It's currently out in the Pacific, off the coast of the Philippines. And this is how they're going to take us there. In one of the US Navy's innovative tilt-rotor Osprey aircraft. They are quite amazing looking, like something out of Star Wars.
We've been invited to observe the Carl Vinson on a joint exercise with the French and Japanese navies. US fighter jets thundered down the flight deck, shrouded with steam from the catapults, with a deafening roar.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us here today aboard USS Carl Vinson.
We were welcomed by Rear Admiral Michael Woshi, who commands the Carl Vinson Strike Group.
It is a beautiful day out here in the Philippine Sea, and it's great to be here with my fellow Strike Group commanders, Rear Admiral Malone.
And sitting alongside him were fellow Rear Admirals from the accompanying French and Japanese carriers.
Carrier Strike Group 1 team is honored to be sailing alongside our French and Japanese allies as we participate in Pacific Stellar 2025.
There was a bonhomie and warmth between the three men that seemed a world away from the recent bitter exchanges between President Trump's men and U.S. allies in Europe.
Our network of strong alliances and partnerships, such as those that we share with France and Japan, is a key advantage of our nations as we confront our collective security challenges.
So we're down in this incredible hangar, surrounded by some of the most advanced fighter planes you can find anywhere in the world. There's a constant checking and replacing of parts going on here to keep these planes operational. There are 60 on board the USS Carl Vinson. And there's no other country that can project this kind of military force over such long distances. But it's a very expensive operation, and there are questions being asked whether this kind of technology, this massive size, is still relevant in 21st century warfare.
You have been nominated to be the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary is responsible for leading a department of 3.5 million service members and civilians.
At the Senate confirmation hearings for new Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last month, he was asked about the administration's military priorities. And despite its declared determination to slash costs, it seems building new ships, including aircraft carriers, will be exempted.
President Trump has said definitively that shipbuilding will be one of his absolute top priorities of this administration. If we're going to defend our interests, our allies, and put America first, we're going to have to be able to project power. That means shipbuilding. It means historic investments in our defense industrial base there.
It is an intricate task, maneuvering 60 warplanes around a space the size of 3 football fields. As they come into land, the pilots must ensure their arrestor hooks catch the steel cable pulled taut across the deck, and they slam to a halt in just 100 metres. For all of the unpredictability of today's America, out in the vast expanse of the Pacific, giant supercarriers like the Carl Vinson remain at the heart of US strategy.
And that was the BBC's Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reporting aboard one of the US Navy's largest aircraft carriers. This is NewsHour. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. Is Russia allowing its soldiers to execute Ukrainian prisoners of war? A documentary called Film Me, which is on the website of the Financial Times, documents its investigation into social media and drone footage showing soldiers who have surrendered being put to death. Christopher Miller from the Financial Times spoke to my colleague Sean Lay.
So these are extrajudicial killings of Ukrainian soldiers who have laid down their arms, put their hands above their head or behind their backs, and come out and surrendered. And Russian soldiers, instead of taking them captive, as you know, the rules of war dictate, they're gunning them down, sometimes at point blank range, or forcing them to kneel and then shooting them in the back. So one of the cases that first brought my attention to what I thought was this pattern of executions by Russian soldiers on the battlefield was a case just at the end of the first year of Russia's full-scale invasion involving a Ukrainian soldier by the name of Oleksandr Matsievsky. And there was a video that was found on Russian social media that quickly spread across the internet like wildfire. And it's Matsievsky looking into the camera after being captured by Russian soldiers, lighting a cigarette and being asked if he has any final words. And those final words are glory to Ukraine, or Slava Ukraini in Ukrainian. And he instantly became posthumously this Ukrainian hero and symbol of Ukrainian resistance. And we managed to speak with his mother, Paraska Demchuk, for this film.
When they showed me the video, I recognized my son by his posture. And immediately it struck me like lightning. I shouted, "Sasha!" It is so painful to watch how he was executed, those final moments of his life.
We found and traced a Russian soldier from that brigade. His name is Oleg Yakovlev, and we believe that he is a hooded man and an executioner in this video. We traced him from the battlefield back to his hometown of Saratov, Russia, south of Moscow. And we believe that in doing so, we've shown evidence that links the battlefield executions to senior commanders and then all the way up to the Kremlin. This brigade that was involved in this was given a state award and this special guards order from the Kremlin back in the summer of 2024.
What has Oleg Yakovlev said to you about the claim you've made?
So I did connect with him over the Russian version of Facebook, VK. He did say that he did not kill them, but he wouldn't go into details. When I pressed him further, he said that he would prefer to keep the details silent and not elaborate further.
Could this not just be rogue elements in Russia's military rather than a kind of sanctioned policy?
What we did is confirmed more than 30 cases of executions on the battlefield. And we believe there are much more because these are merely the ones that we were able to view through drone footage or footage posted by Russian soldiers themselves online and confirm and geolocate and know where they took place. And the number of them, there was just a huge spike over the course of 2024. We saw a big increase in cases, and so did the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's Office. And to them, this leads them to believe and viewed as a policy.
Christopher Miller, and he was speaking to my colleague Sean Lay. A word before we go about the German elections. They're taking place on Sunday and a lot seems to be riding on them. Not just that Europe's biggest economy is stuttering, but also that the far right is showing strongly in the opinion polls and that Germany, like the rest of Europe, is having to conjure with Donald Trump ripping up the old world order. Lots of uncertainty, but the utter certainty and the good news for public service broadcasting, at least, is that we've got NewsHour's James Kumarasamy in Germany for the elections. James, going into Sunday, what is your view of how the election is looking?
Well, Tim, welcome, I should say, to a chilly Berlin. The white vestiges of a late winter snowfall are on the ground and in the air going into that election. Say an uncharacteristic sense of anxiety and vulnerability for the very reasons you've just mentioned. Even before Donald Trump came to power and shook up the geopolitical order, well, Germany's energy-intensive, export-driven economy was already flatlining, cut off from deep Russian oil and gas following the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, facing competition in its key car industry from China, and its social model under strain from recent waves of immigration. There's a sense of insecurity that's come with that, enhanced by that recent spate of attacks by asylum seekers. Well, the opinion polls seem to have been about as stagnant as the economy, and this campaign's largely been seen as a pretty long coronation of the centre-right CDU leader Friedrich Merz as the next chancellor, albeit, I have to say, with the party on the far radical right, the AfD. It's been polling at historic highs in second place. But then, well, Germany became caught up in what one paper here called a geopolitical whirlwind. Donald Trump's threat of tariffs, particularly threatening to the economy, Mr. Trump's two right-hand men, J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, endorsing the AfD, and then, well, those US-Russian talks taking this staunch supporter of Ukraine blindsided. Doesn't seem to have moved the dial much, but it certainly shifted the rhetoric. Mr. Merz warned today Europe has to prepare for Donald Trump no longer upholding NATO's mutual defence agreement. He's wondered whether America could slide into an authoritarian populist system, although it has to be said he's also been accused of pandering to the populists and after he relied on far-right votes for a parliamentary motion on tougher immigration rules.
Now, such a brilliant summary. I'm sort of slightly hesitant to ask whether you've got anything left to say in your broadcasting over the weekend and following on, but tell me what your plans are.
Much more to say, Tim, of course. Now, we're looking in a bit more detail at immigration. It's been the leading factor in this election campaign. I mean, certainly until the last couple of days when Ukraine has come along to try and sort of nudge it out of the way. It has, though, been very important. We've been talking to one immigrant success story, a Syrian refugee who cooked for none other than Angela Merkel as she came over in 2015, thanks to the former chancellor. She's also debated the AfD, and we've also been to the other side of it, a cafe that's suffered arson attacks for hosting some open-minded discussions about events in the Middle East. We're also heading out of town, getting a historical perspective on why Eastern Germany is such fertile ground for the AfD from, appropriately enough, a historian who grew up in a small town in the state of Brandenburg. And then, of course, Sunday, results day, we'll have a special edition of NewsHour with all those. And then we'll have the slow, deliberate formation of a coalition government. Now, depending on results, as you well know, Tim, you get one of these more efficient common or garden grand coalitions, or perhaps an intricate combination of parties named by the colours they go by. So you get to know your traffic light from your Jamaica from, and this was a new one to me, your BlackBerry coalition. All to look forward to.
James, we do look forward to it. Thank you very much. James Kamara-Sami with a look ahead to the sorts of coalitions. I think there's a Kenya coalition as well that could conceivably come out of the German elections this weekend. Much more to come from him. But from this edition of NewsHour, thanks for listening.